Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our case for argument, United States versus Black. Mr. Estrada.
Thank you, Judge Posner, and may it please the Court. Everything that matters in this case has changed since 2008. The error is now conceded, or at least indisputable. The burden is on the government, and this is not a sufficiency of the evidence case. The government today must confront the entire record, not merely the parts of the record it likes. He must deal with the Rattler. He must deal with the text of the charging instrument, the information that went into the jury. He must deal with the jury instruction. And importantly, he must also deal with the acquittal. It is our submission today that none of the fraud or obstruction convictions can survive that type of examination. Now, let me say quickly on the fraud. It is important to keep in mind that the government expressly argued to the district judge for the theory of honest services as a basis for letting the case go to the jury in the first place. That's record at 717. There is a quotation that we have in our reply on the rule at 54 at footnote 3, page 10. The government, after the jury came back, on the exact same basis, once again argued to the district court. This is a record 904, pages 9 to 10, that the jury could have found the defendant guilty even if it believed the money was theirs based on the honest services theory. Now, the government in its briefing changed its tack somewhat when they were last before you, but you yourselves may recall that Judge Sykes asked Mr. Sisko, who was arguing for the government, whether the government had argued in the district court that this conviction could be sustained solely upon the services. And it is a colloquy worth listening to again. Mr. Sisko said, well, we didn't so argue explicitly. However, and then he explained how the instructions would allow the conviction and ended up urging you that this was a permissible basis on the record. And the
well, let me ask you about the form and Paxson sales, because your brief is puzzling. You say, I'm looking at page 10 of your, you know, the most recent filing, and you say that you haven't argued that the $600,000 in those payments were recharacterized management fees. Well, if there weren't, why? How could the jury have convicted except by thinking that this was a theft? Right? There's no non-compete agreement. They just get the $600,000. So.
What that is.
Right. There's no agreement. You had no agreement. Right.
There was no agreement that was signed.
No agreement. Yeah. No agreement.
Well,
they get it anyway. And so how would the jury? What's the theory on which the jury would convict, but only on basis of honest services fraud?
Sure. I mean, that is actually pretty.
You get $600,000 and you don't have any agreement that entitles you to it. That looks like old-fashioned fraud.
I mean, Judge Posner, no, it isn't. Actually, you know, the clients are as innocent of that as they are in the other counts. But let me just sort of point out.
What do you mean innocent? Look, they were convicted of that, right? So what do you mean by innocent?
In a trial in which the jury was permitted to find them guilty of something that.
Yes, but I don't understand. How could they have found honest services fraud but not theft with regard to that $600,000?
Because the issue on that count, Judge Posner, was not whether these were management fees. We never contended.
That's right. That's right.
The issue was the intent to defraud, and the fact that the non-competition agreements had been approved by the board and the executive committee.
But look, if there's no intent to defraud, they can't be convicted of anything.
Well, they cannot be convicted of anything, but here the jury was.
So the jury must have found that there was an intent to defraud, and the intent to defraud means taking $600,000 and put in your pocket without having any right to it, without having any contractual right or any other right.
That was certainly one of the options the jury had.
No, that's the only option, because look, If they find no intent to defraud, they can't convict of either honest services fraud or monetary fraud. So they must have found intent to defraud. And the only intent to defraud that I can see would be taking the $600,000.
Disclosure, I understand what the argument that you're outlining is. If I could be permitted three sentences to actually respond to it, I really would appreciate it. The issue here was those were approved by the executive committee and the board.
That's what you say. Now, if they were approved, then there isn't any basis for honest services fraud.
Well, there was a basis for the jury to conclude that the absence of procedural regularity, the actual drafting of the agreements, even though they were intended to be there, that the failure to draft them and sign them.
No, that doesn't make any sense.
But it does if you consider that the jury acquitted on counts 2 and 3, the identical transactions based on the same testimony, where the buyers from Forum and Case.
They weren't identical. What, the other Forum and Paxson? No, they had agreements in those cases.
Well, right,
that's a big difference. Like, they get the money, there's no agreement. The other cases, there are agreements.
Well, that is a difference. Judge Posner, but it's also the case that the testimony that the government proffered to the jury to underlie both counts was that the buyers never wanted either. And if the jury had not been skeptical of the testimony of the government, then it could not possibly have acquitted. On this stage, we are entitled not to have the evidence looked at in the light most favorable to the government, but to assess under Chapman and Yates versus Abbott whether there is a reasonable...
The question is, what would a reasonable jury have done, right? And a reasonable jury could not have convicted them on this $600,000, I don't think, on the basis of honest services fraud. It could only be on the basis of simple theft.
I think that is not consistent with the instructions that the jury was given, Judge Posner.
We're not talking about instructions because instructional error is not conclusive. If no reasonable jury could have found them guilty of honest services, if a reasonable jury could only have found guilt of theft, then the instructional error drops out.
But you could only come to that conclusion by giving the government the benefit of inferences, which at this stage it is not entirely.
I don't see that. It seems to me this is a very simple issue. Either there was no agreement, but they get the $600,000. Either they did that because it was just some oversight, that's your argument. Someone forgot to draft the agreement. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that it is a fraud. And the jury, in finding it was a fraud, rejected your accident theory. And I don't know what else there is to say about that.
One of the flaws in that line of reasoning, Judge Posner, happens to be that it presumes that in order for the defendants to win, these theories had to be tendered to the jury as fully exclusive alternatives.
You're going back to instructional error, and you're not facing the fact, as it seems to me, that if a reasonable jury could only have found one of these offenses, and they certainly were charged, I mean, the instructions did allow them to find a theft of this money, then the instructional error drops out.
I am going back to instructional error, Judge Posner, because it belies the apparent premise of your questioning that in order for the defendants to win, you had to conclude that the jury had fully exclusive alternatives. In other words, that honest services was one circle in a Venn diagram and that theft by fraud was a different circle. Now, the problem with the nature of this alternative formulation was that at the very best, the honest services circle had a dot in the middle that was theft, so that the nature of the error that is being challenged here is not...
I mean, you've lost me. Was the jury not instructed on monetary fraud as a theory?
It was instructed on monetary fraud as a theory.
Well, if a reasonable jury applying that instruction to the Forum and Paxson would have said, yes, this is fraud. This is either fraud or it's innocent, right? It's innocent if this was just an accident. But if there was an intent to defraud, it was an intent to take the $600,000.
Right. But
It's not an intent to, you know, have a tax advantage against the Canadians or to, you know, put management fees into another pocket. It wasn't that, right?
Some of that is right. Unfortunately for the government, is not all that relevant, because ultimately you have to contend as well that one of the vices with the honest services instruction, and I know that I'm going back to the instruction, but I think a actual understanding of the nature of the problem really is essential in figuring out the nature of the harm to the defendants. And the honest services instruction had many features that were erroneous. One of them went to the intent element, which told the jury, disjunctively as well, that in order to convict the defendants of money fraud, they basically had to intend to steal. But on honest services, if you read the instruction, a mere non-disclosure of pertinent facts could be enough for the intent to defraud. Now, your question, in addition from having, I think, what I think is the wrong assumption that these were fully non-overlapping.
Okay, what is your theory? What is your conception of how a jury that convicted them of, when the 600 to Forum and Paxson, what's your conception of how the jury framed that conviction in honest services terms? What was their thinking? What is the thinking process that leads there?
It is at the bottom of paragraph 21 in count one of the indictment, which asserts, and the jury has this in front of them, that a failure to disclose a related party transaction is honest services fraud. And so if the defendants intended not to disclose that under the instructions, they were guilty of fraud. They could not be guilty of any theft. But in the government's information, and this is again true again for the APC counts at the bottom of paragraph 30, it was asserted and they were instructed that the failure to disclose the transaction was itself an available fraud for this conviction.
That's not the argument you make in your brief.
Well, we have made that and many other arguments. It's actually a fact. I do understand that the government would like to cast this as though there were alternatives. But in fact, there were alternatives, but the theft that they claim was fully included within the honest services. The jury did not have to find theft, which is the relevant point.
Let me ask you about one or the other, the obstruction of justice. I don't see that. I don't understand your argument about obstruction of justice. Is it somehow that... Since he couldn't be guilty of honest services fraud because it's not a non-existent crime, he couldn't have obstructed justice? Is that the argument? Is the argument?
We actually expressly stated that was not our argument.
What is your argument?
Our argument is that anybody who's tried a case knows that a jury is more likely to convict you of obstruction if they think you're actually guilty of the crime. Based on the very common...
But that is departing from the... the assumption, which is fundamental, that the question is what would a reasonable jury have done, not a jury that has some predisposition in favor of people who obstruct justice but have not committed a crime.
Well,
see, this is, I think, a weakness in your general position. You don't focus on the fact that we have to decide, could a reasonable jury have acquitted of obstruction of justice if honest services fraud wasn't in the case. And I don't see the connection between the honest services fraud and the obstruction.
Well, the first connection is that they were expressly instructed that the proceeding in this case, which turned out to be flawed, was one of the proceedings that was a predicate for the obstruction conviction. That is just a Yates legal error that has the same ambiguity as the other fraud counts. Apart from that, you also have, you know, the proposition...
That's an error in your favor.
Well, no.
Well, yes.
It's an error in the government's favor.
No, not if they say you have to find honest services fraud in order to find obstruction of justice. That's an error in your favor.
Yeah, but I think we are talking about...
And you can't use errors in your favor to upset the...
But it's not an error in my favor, Judge Posner. If... I think you are talking about whether or not there was actually an official proceeding, and indeed...
All you need is an intent, right, for obstruction.
Well, we need a corrupt intent and a nexus.
Well, there's certainly a corrupt intent.
Well, that was a question...
Well,
I
know, but the jury convicted him, and there's plenty of evidence that it was a corrupt intent. He's trying to conceal, trying to hide evidence from the SEC and so on.
It would be difficult to understand the circularity of that reasoning, Judge Posner, because if you start with the proposition that they had an error and they found him guilty anyway, then it seems that...
The error is irrelevant. The error is either in your favor or it's irrelevant.
But the error is...
All you need for the obstruction of justice is that the defendant was trying to obstruct an SEC investigation by removing, hiding these documents, right? That's a simple case. I don't see what it has to do with the honest services count.
Right. And by a parity of reasoning, you could...
Parity of reasoning. What does it have to do with the honest services count?
No, the question of the motivation for the removal of the documents was a central issue in this trial, Judge Posner. If one...
Right, to hide the documents from the SEC.
Or to move them to another place.
Well,
if
they'd found that, they would have acquitted him.
No, because their conviction that he was actually guilty enabled them to conclude that he was more
that's
likely...
Not, that's not a, re- that's not a reasonable... Ju- that's not a reasonable...
On term. The obstruction count...
Yes.
There was visual evidence, and visual evidence, as anybody who has tried a case knows, is very powerful.
Right, but it was equally consistent with both sides' stories. I mean, the government put a spin on it that he was trying to hide from the cameras. The argument, if you saw it, was that he was clearly ticked off and pointing at the cameras. Now, this may have been a high-handed thing for him to do, but the notion that the only inference that was possible on the basis of all the evidence, including the fact that he had to get all the stuff out of, after being there for 27 years, and everything else that he did that day, that the only possible inference was that he was attempting to obstruct the proceedings.
No, it's not the only possible inference. It's the inference drawn by the jury.
Yes, on the basis of a misapprehension as to whether reasonably...
So you're saying it confused her. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Estrada. We'll hear from Mr. Chang. We'll give you a minute later.
May it please the Court, the instructional error here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And we know this because the government presented one factual theory in support of both the honest services fraud and the legally valid money fraud. That straightforward theory...
Well, what about... So if we look at the APC case, the Mammoth case... that's the one they convict. That's one convicted of.
Right.
So couldn't the jury have believed that they were owed these management fees? They wanted to scam the Canadian government, which is irrelevant to us. And so they pretended that these management fees were actually compensation for covenant not to compete. In doing this, they were depriving the board of directors of their honest services, because if the board had known about the Canadian tax advantage, they might have, negotiated for a higher fee or something like that.
No, Your Honor, there's no risk the jury did that for a number of reasons. First, the government never asked the jury to convict on that factual basis. And... reviewing this from the perspective of a reasonable jury, listening to the presentation of the factual and legal arguments by the government and the defense, it is unreasonable, I think, to assume that a jury would come up with a theory of conviction that the government didn't present and that the defense didn't...
But you did predict, but you did obviously present an honest services theory. Was it just with regard to the other... the ones they acquitted on, or what?
No. We did advance honest services, the theory of guilt, on each and every one of the mail and wire fraud counts. But the legal label, but all we did was put a legal label, in addition to money fraud, on the same factual basis. That is, that the defendants stole this money with Mark Kipnis's help, stole this money from the company. And not because of some, not in order to get a Canadian tax break, and that they were simply recharacterizing owed management fees. We never asked the jury to convict on that basis.
You did argue for conviction based on the failure to submit these payments to the audit committee and the board for approval and other sort of iterations of a non-disclosure theory, which was clearly part of the jury instructions.
Well, just like we argued that that non-disclosure was evidence of the defendant's concealment their theft of money from the company. But we never argued that standing alone, those non-disclosures standing alone, would form the basis of a conviction, whether money fraud or honesty.
Well, how do we know that the jury didn't convict on that basis, since that was argued as a factual matter and clearly was in evidence, and the jury was invited based on the instructions to convict on that basis?
Well, I don't think the jury was invited to convict on that basis.
Well, what's the point of the instructions about Delaware fiduciary duty law and this concept of a transaction being entirely fair in order to satisfy the duty of loyalty that officers and directors owe to the corporation, and that definition of fair dealing and fair price folded into the idea of a transaction being entirely fair is extremely broad. Well, and includes if it's not properly disclosed, if it's not properly initiated, if it's not properly structured, negotiated, et cetera.
Just like all of those instructions were put before the jury, because the jury first had to find, as a threshold matter, before the defendants could be convicted of honest services fraud, which was defined affirmatively as the misuse of the defendant's position for private gain. That was the affirmative definition. Okay. A threshold matter was that the defendants had to owe a fiduciary duty. Another threshold requirement was that the defendants had to breach that fiduciary duty. But there was an instruction that was explicit from the district court, and this is on page 28 of the jury instructions, which is record 771, that a breach of fiduciary duty by an officer or director or controlling shareholder under Delaware law does not, in and of itself, amount to a violation of the mail or wire fraud statute. So the jury first had to find a misuse of position for private gain. Immediately following that affirmative instruction as to what honest services fraud is, was an instruction that compensation that's earned in the normal course of business with above board channels, I'm paraphrasing that, was not private gain. Okay. And that made sense because the factual dispute that the parties had, that the government had with the defense, was whether or not the defendant stole this money, and not whether there was just a mere non-disclosure.
Well, what about, I don't see how you responded to my question. If they say, the management, we were owed these management fees, and we had them characterized as non-compete, as compensation for covenants not to compete, so that we could, rip off the Canadians. Couldn't the jury have believed that and said, yes, that's honest services fraud, because maybe the board, if they'd known, would have done something. But that wouldn't be theft of money, right?
Well, it wouldn't be theft of money if it was actually owed management fees. But I guess I have two responses. One is, I don't think a reasonable jury would have found, as a factual matter, that this was purely owed management fees that was then not disclosed in order to get a Canadian tax break. One reason I think the jury would not have done so is, as I was saying, the government never asked that the jury to so find. And I think it's unreasonable to assume that the jury is...
But honest services is, if it existed, or it did exist, it was a very effective rebuttal to their argument, right? Because they say, management fees just recharacterized. And you can say, well, that's irrelevant because, they have to deal honestly with the board of directors. Right? So,
and
you must have felt that having honest service, this is related to Judge Sykes' question, you must have felt having honest services in there was a help to you.
Well, two things. Let me take that first point first, which is the government never did argue, either in its initial opening or its rebuttal. You say it would be an effective rebuttal. It would have been an effective rebuttal. We never argued that to the jury. You know, we still, even in our rebuttal argument, told the jury that the defendants, you know, for example, were robbing the shareholders of honest services because they were stealing money from the company. And one of the best examples of that is during the rebuttal, the prosecutor said, "These are Hollinger International's assets that are being sold. They owe their duty to Hollinger International." So this is the prosecutor explaining honest services in the rebuttal. So when I put on here honest services and duty of loyalty, he's referring to the PowerPoint he had. That's what I'm talking about. That's the fraud in this case. The shareholders of Hollinger International are getting defrauded out of that $16.5 million because the buyers never wanted this stuff. So that's the theft. And that's just one example of the prosecutor in the rebuttal explaining and linking the honest services fraud to the theft. And so you will not find an even-if argument, as effective as it might have been. We didn't present that argument. So that's one point. The other question you asked was, we must have felt it had some value. Well, I must say that, generally speaking, if you present you present us with two possible ways, two legal theories to convict a defendant, we will ask for, we'll ask for the two rather than the one. And that's because, juries are unpredictable. We do assume.
Let me take you back to the obstruction of justice. What was the evidence, what was contained in those boxes?
Some of the non-compete agreements were in those boxes. It's true that the SEC and the investigators had obtained some of these documents. But the fact that the defendant Black had some of those documents in his personal possession, of course, would be relevant to investigators. That's why investigators ask for documents, not only from a company generally, but from individuals. And the defendant was on notice that the investigators would be serving document production requests, had served document production requests on the defendant.
But there was other material irrelevant to the criminal charge, right?
Yes, there are personal effects as well. But what the evidence showed, given that there were relevant and responsive documents, the evidence showed that given the timing of the defendant's removal of the boxes, sneaking out the back, waiting for the building to close, not enlisting help to remove these 13 boxes, pointing to the video cameras, as Judge Sykes pointed out, he's pointing to the old video cameras that had been up there, and unbeknownst to him, there had been newly installed video cameras in nondescript locations that he didn't know about. And so he was caught on video obstructing.
Does that mean he thought the ones that he pointed to were not operating, or they wouldn't produce good images, or what was that?
Well, it's pointing out that he knows the locations of these cameras, and so he ought to avoid being captured on those cameras. But what he didn't know is that he was being captured on other video cameras. And I just want to make sure that it's to return to the honest services convictions for a moment, that I think it's also very telling that the defense was never argued in their closing argument that there was some other factual theory that the government had and that you ought not to convict on.
Right, but in a complex fraud case like this, this is a 4-month trial, right? And 16 counts, RICO counts, and tax fraud counts, and no securities fraud count, but securities issues lurking underneath the surface, and multiple fraud counts, and the obstruction counts. So there's a lot of evidence that the jury has to cope with. This is a jury of lay people. In a complex fraud case, it's extremely important how the government conceptualizes the fraud and how the court submits the fraud theories to the jury, the fraud counts to the jury on the instructions. That takes on much more significance than in a garden variety armed robbery case or some other sort of a crime. And these counts were conceptualized on alternative bases. That runs through the jury instructions. Clearly, the jury was invited to convict on either or. The jury instructions are always stated in the disjunctive. And the way that it was argued, Ms. Reuter argued the crime in this case is not about the fact that the defendants got money. It's not that by itself. The crime in this case is that the defendants hid and lied about the true reasons why they got money. That's a nondisclosure theory. And that's submitted as an alternative basis in this case. And then, you know, there's other references of a like nature running through the closing argument and the government's rebuttal closing argument, which is the last thing the jury hears before the case is the instructions are submitted by the court and the jury gets the case. And that's of enormous significance in how the jury evaluates the evidence, a jury of laypeople in a complex fraud case after 4 months of evidence.
Right, Judge Sykes, I agree with the observation that in a complex fraud case, how the parties conceptualize the arguments are crucial. And that's why I think it is in our favor that the government never argued to the jury that a mere nondisclosure is sufficient. And indeed, in the passage that Your Honor quoted,
stealing money and property is one kind of intent to defraud, and that is serious. Depriving the company and the shareholders of honest services, breaching this duty of loyalty, is just as serious, and it's part of the fraud that's alleged in this case. It's an invitation to view the evidence in alternative ways and base a conviction on different theories.
Well,
and if, you know, a couple of the jurors accepted that this wasn't stealing, but it was a breach of the duty of loyalty, and there was a scheme, that's enough to convict.
No, but the crucial thing is that the government argued only one theory as to one factual theory. I'm sorry.
Two legal theories.
Two legal theories, but based on one factual theory, which is that the defendant stole.
Well, then why put in all the stuff about Delaware corporate law and what the fiduciary duties owed consisted of?
Well,
what's the point of all that evidence?
Well, there's two points. One is that under this court's case law at the time, misuse of position for private gain required, or arguably required, a breach of fiduciary duty, required as a threshold matter. So we had to put in evidence of fiduciary duty. And the second purpose of the evidence was it was used to explain why the board members trusted the defendants, because they were able to, they got hoodwinked in this case, the board did, because they put trust in the defendants, because the defendants owed a fiduciary duty under Delaware law.
So it wasn't introduced as an alternative basis for conviction?
We had to introduce that evidence to make out a misuse of office, a position for private gain.
Right, because that's an element of honest services fraud, or was under the law of this circuit.
Right.
Well, I think what you're saying is that one way of committing a fraud, one way of getting money fraudulently, is to violate one's fiduciary duties to shareholders or what have you. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, even back then, even on the, we know that's not right now, but under the case law at the time, a mere breach of fiduciary duty.
No, what I'm saying is, trying to see if I understand what, when you say two legal theories, one factual theory, I think what you're saying is that there are many different ways to defraud somebody of money, and one would be just lying to the person. Saying I'm going to invest your money and it's going to generate tremendous returns when really it's a Ponzi scheme. That's a form of fraud. Another form of fraud might be concealing something from your board of directors. But if you're saying if you're stealing money, see, I guess the sense in which honest services fraud does survive the Skilling and the Black cases in the Supreme Court, if there's money involved. Isn't that true?
Well, after Skilling, it has to be a bribery or kickback scheme. But what our submission is that we argued that the theft of the money was both a violation of 1341.
So you're saying I'm stating too broadly what is left of honest services.
I think so, Your Honor.
Okay, it has to be broad. Okay, that's fine.
It has to be bribery kickback scheme, but I think the point remains true that what we argue to the jury and what, you know, based on the defense arguments as well, the jury was presented with one factual question. And if they believe that the defendant stole the money from the company, then they ought to convict both under the money fraud theory and the honest services.
What if they didn't believe that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What if they didn't believe that this was a theft?
Then they would have acquitted.
But you didn't tell them. See, you didn't tell the jury. Well, you know, if you decide they didn't take anything, well, fine, then we're not going to. Then you shouldn't convict, right? That's the missing link.
Right, and the court didn't tell the jury that either. So the court had that option available.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there any discussion of a special verdict?
Yeah.
Yes, there was. We initially proposed a special verdict form, and the defendants resisted, or at least resisted to the point of they wanted the special verdict form to go back after the defendants returned a jury verdict.
Right.
And so this was the issue that went up in the Supreme Court under as to whether or not the absence of that special verdict form or our proposal of it would mean that the defendants forfeited, you know, this Yates error, which the Supreme Court, you know, rejected that position. And so we are, despite having proposed a special verdict form, we are in a position of having to try to...
Let me just ask, give Mr. Estrada more time, give you a little more time. What about this, the APC and the Mammoth case? Do you have a response to Mr. Estrada's argument about that?
There's some internal inconsistency. I mean, on the one hand, there's still the argument that this was somehow a genuine non-compete and agreement. And I think it's clear that, you know, this is not a genuine non-compete agreement. There was only the Mammoth Times left. It's a subsidiary of International itself. There's no genuine non-compete agreement there. There's some argument that the defense makes that, it's a genuine non-compete because it bound these senior executives to not compete not just with this Mammoth Times, you know, newspaper that was left within APC, but also all of APC's, you know, affiliates. And that's just...
Sorry. I asked you that. I confused it. I understand the Mammoth issue. No, I meant the $600,000.
Okay. So on Foreman Paxton.
Yeah.
All right. So are these legitimate non-compete agreements? And there was an oversight. Okay, they forgot to execute them. No. Lloyd Case, the CEO of Forum, right, who has no reason to lie, he's the buyer in the Forum deal, said he didn't want to non-compete. And similarly in Paxton, Paxton just wanted the non-compete from International, but not the senior executives. And so there's no reason to have a non-compete when the buyers aren't asking for it. So it's not a matter of oversight. There's no genuine non-compete there. And I think you're right that your observation was correct, that if the jury had believed there was no intent of the fraud, that there was just an oversight, well, then it would have acquitted.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chang. So, Mr. Starr, your time expired, but you can have another couple of minutes.
Yes, there's a lot to cover. You know, the one thing that I agree with that you said, Judge Posner, was during the argument of my opponent, you said that everything was irrelevant if you did not deal honestly with the board. And that's the fundamental problem here, both as to what the error is and as to why the government cannot show prejudice. To take the issue of Foreman Paxton, which I know you questioned me about, I will go back again to what the information told the jury. And based on the arguments and the instructions and the evidence, the jury could reasonably have concluded that failing to draft the contracts was an oversight and an accident and not a theft, but that the later subsequent failure to tell the board
was a breach of a fiduciary duty. And that would allow a fully effective basis for conviction on count 7, which has absolutely whatsoever nothing to do with fraud.
And what's the relationship between count 7 and counts 2 and 3?
There is a relationship. Exactly right. I mean, one of the things that is astonishing to me about this case is that if the jury had believed all of these people, they would have convicted on everything. Forum and Paxton are sort of exemplary of that. Karen, Case and Paxton both testified that they had no slightest interest on the Hollinger Inc. non-compete contract, which were at issue in counts 2 and 3. If the jury had thought they were telling the truth, they would have convicted on counts 2 and 3. And so it is nearly impossible, as we have, I think, demonstrated, that you can say that a jury could only have reached the conclusion that is favorable to the government by the required standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. I will say briefly about obstruction. The testimony of the government's own witnesses, the security guard, was that the change in the cameras covered the exact same area. If, you know, he clearly knew cameras were there. He was pointing at the old ones, and the new ones were elsewhere.
No, but the problem is the lack of any analytical connection between the obstruction of justice and the other and the honest services fraud.
The analytical connection was spelled out in the instructions, which told the jury that if he intended to obstruct a not yet pending proceeding, which is, you know, the future criminal prosecution, that was by itself a basis for conviction. To be sure, they had other options, but this is why it is of a piece of the same needs ambiguity.
I don't understand. He certainly could be prosecuted even if there were no honest services conception, right?
Yes, but he certainly would not have been convicted, which is the point of the second.
No, I don't understand. I mean, when he was removing those boxes, you know, he knew he faced potential criminal proceedings.
What? And if we had a reasonable assurance that the jury based the conviction on that and concluded that he acted corruptly on that basis, then he would be correct. But the problem here is one of ambiguity of the verdict. And the key phrase here is not whether there was going to be a proceeding, but whether he was acting corruptly.
But a reasonable jury, I don't see how a reasonable jury could convict him of obstruction of justice because of some misunderstanding of honest service. I don't get it.
No, a reasonable jury would think it more likely that of the two available explanations for his conduct, the corrupt one and the non-corrupt one, that the corrupt one was more likely if he in fact was guilty of something. And given that it is highly likely that they thought he was guilty of honest services fraud, their conception in picking the inferences from the evidence was unavoidably tainted by their understanding of what the proceeding was. Not because there was no official proceeding. I mean, if the U.S. attorney takes a notion to investigate me for having an affair with Minnie Mouse and actually calls a grand jury, there is undoubtedly an official proceeding. But if I burn my Disney comics, I don't think people would say I acted corruptly. And the point here is there were...
On the contrary. You burned them because you were afraid you were going to be prosecuted for your relationship with Minnie Mouse. Right?
Well,
did no other inference.
Well,
why else would you burn your comics?
No, the inference as to the motivation is correct. Whether or not it is corrupt is a different matter. And the question here is, don't forget, I mean, there was an entirely plausible, indeed compelling basis for conclusion.
But the difference also with the Minnie Mouse, even though the Supreme Court held that the honest services theory was invalid, still reasonable people believed it was a serious offense and a lawful offense. And so if you try to put yourself in your client's mind, he would worry that he could be convicted of honest services fraud, and therefore he better, you know, see what's in these documents. Maybe conveniently lose some of them.
Yeah, except that every piece of paper in that office, as was testified at trial, had been examined, and all of the, you know.
Oh, no, now you're getting to the merits of the obstruction of justice, right?
Of course I am. And the question is, my client was entitled to a jury trial on the obstruction charge. He had.
But you're saying every instructional error is reversible.
No, I am saying that where there is a hotly contested issue, as this court said in the L.E. Myers case, and that is the centerpiece of the trial, you cannot simply assume that in the absence of the error, the jury would have discounted the exculpatory explanation, which actually turned out to be far more compelling than the inculpatory explanation. If we were to start every harmless error case with the proposition that the fact finding is obviously the first premise in the jury, and the jury found you guilty, then no conviction would ever be harmless. And that is just an untenable view of the logic. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement, and the court will recess.